This episode is brought to you by IVP. We want the thousands of hours we work over our lifetime to matter. How do we go from being defined by what we do to having our work become an expression of who we are? Barry Rowan suggests it begins with surrendering our whole lives to God. In The Spiritual Art of Business, Rowan, who is called the corporate mystic, invites us to be transformed by God, that he might transform the world through us as we begin to see our work as an extension of our faith. And as a listener of this podcast, you can receive this book for 25% off when you use the promo code IVPOD25. That's IVPOD25 at ivypress.com.
This is IVP.
Blessing is found in the midst of and on the other side of suffering. It is the psalm that Jesus quotes or invokes when he's on the cross, and it's the psalm of a sufferer who nonetheless, by the end of the psalm, is proclaiming the goodness of God. And that's blessing. It's not avoiding suffering or getting these kind of cheat codes to the universe. Blessing is actually being implicated in all the sorrow of the universe and all the sorrow of your own story and that of those around you, and nonetheless finding that there is real life in the midst of it and beyond.
Hey, everybody. Welcome back to the Digital Examine podcast. I'm Jay, your host, and thank you again for joining us on this journey as we explore the possibility of noticing God in all of life through the ups and the downs and everything in between. Some of you know my story. I grew up in California, but I was not born here. I was born in South Korea in a city called Incheon, South Korea. I lived there for the first 4 years of my life before my mother and I moved to the U.S. And what that means is that my first language, my native tongue, was Korean. And I still have these memories of early elementary school. After I was in California and enrolled in a public school, I remember taking ESL classes, English as a second language, in first and second grade, because the language I was most familiar with and comfortable speaking and hearing was Korean, and English was the foreign language. Now, fast forward about four decades, and this is hard to admit, it's kind of sad, but I have essentially lost my ability. For many decades, I have lost the ability to speak adequate Korean. I can speak it a little bit, probably at the level of like a kindergartner, maybe, which I guess sort of makes sense. That's about when I moved to the States. Anyways, the reason I share that is because I've got two young children now, one in kindergarten and then a fourth grader. I so desperately want to teach them Korean, but I can't because I don't speak it very well. And as I've thought about that journey, I realize it's not because I am not capable of being bilingual. I think I am. It's because I failed to do the daily work of continuing to speak Korean and to hear Korean, to study the language. Now, of course, if I wanted to, I could enroll in a class today and probably pick it right back up. But what I know is it would take time and effort and energy. It wouldn't happen overnight, as is true of most meaningful skill in our lives. But in the digital age, because of these little black boxes that we carry around in our back pockets that we call smartphones, we live in what my friend Andy Crouch calls the superpower zone. He describes it as this feeling, this experience most of us have in the digital age, of experiencing the sensation of strength without experiencing the sensation of effort. Things come easy to us. Everything is easily accessible because of technology, and it's accessible without much effort, kind of like a superpower that you see in a comic book hero you know, these modern myths. And so today I'm talking with my friend Andy Crouch, who has been one of the most influential people in my life in terms of how I've thought about in recent years technology and digital technology in particular, and what it is not just doing for us, but more importantly, what it is doing to us, how these technologies are forming us and in some ways deforming us, and the sort of reformation that many of us need. We talk about how the impact of technology is reshaping and habituating us and making it increasingly challenging in some ways for us to experience deeply and daily the presence of God. If you're not familiar, Andy Crouch is a partner for theology and culture at Praxis, which is a venture building ecosystem that is intent on advancing redemptive entrepreneurship. They're doing incredible work. He serves on the governing board of InterVarsity Christian Fellowship, and he's the author of several books, including The TechWise Family, Culture Making, and the crux of our conversation today is based on his most recent book called The Life We're Looking For, Reclaiming Relationship in a Technological World. It is one of the best books I have read in recent years. I cannot recommend it highly enough. And I think you are going to be challenged and provoked and encouraged and inspired and equipped through this conversation. So without further ado, here is my conversation with my friend, Andy Crouch. Andy, thank you so much for joining us on the Digital Examine podcast.
Thank you, Jay. It is a pleasure to get to talk with you anytime.
Oh, gosh. Yeah. Well, this, all of our conversations are so meaningful to me. This one's uniquely meaningful because you know this, but maybe our listeners don't. Your work and then your friendship from a distance over the last few years has been profoundly beautiful to me, but also like really rich and helpful to me as I've thought through just my own life and my own sort of habits and the way culture has habituated me in some ways. And I think that's one of the reasons why many of the folks who listen to this podcast are listening. We sense an ache within us. And so I want to start by asking you, it's a big, broad question, but you do in your most recent book, The Life We're Looking For, you do such a beautiful job of unpacking the ache. You tell this story early on in the book that I think is familiar to many of us. It's certainly familiar to me. You tell this funny story about getting in the mail what initially looked like a very personal letter from someone.
Yes.
Personal handwritten note. You're like, and that's so rare for us these days. You're like, oh my gosh, what is this? So beautiful. Who's this from? And only to discover it was from a company looking to sell you new Windows.
Yes.
And then you write something that I think in so many ways frames the book. You say that there is a consequential difference between personalized and personal. So I want to ask you to begin, because again, we can relate to the ache, you know, maybe you like expand on that difference and some of the unique challenges we face to personhood in the modern world.
Yes, right. Well, that does capture it pretty well, because I mean, how often do you get a handwritten letter these days? It's so rare, but it was such a good fake. I mean, it completely had me until I opened the envelope. And it turns out that this delightful, alleged young woman, I forget her name, Clarissa or whatever, who works for Anderson Windows, clearly does not, well, maybe she exists. She doesn't know me. She didn't write the letter. It's this incredibly like elaborate personalization, when what we're hungering for is the personal. So, you know, what we're hungering for is the thing we were looking for. The title of my book is The Life We're Looking For. What are we looking for? The moment we're born, we're looking for a face. We're looking for another who looks for us and sees us and knows us. And instead, what we now have actually are extraordinary simulations of being known, but not actually being known. And you know, as you were asking this, Jay, I was wondering, is this new? And I have to think in some ways it's not entirely new. I think there's always been a gap between what human beings are made for and at our best long for, and what we settle for, in a way, or what the world settles for giving us, because it's not always our own choices. It's the systems we're embedded in. So in some ways, that has to be as old as the human, you know, story. But in another way, I do think what we now get from our world are amazing kind of alternatives to getting things done by being a person. And of course, this is what ultimately, I guess I named the window company. I'm pretty sure it was Anderson Windows. It was one of those big companies. You know, Anderson Windows actually has a very valid and valuable mission, which is to let light in while keeping, in my part of the world, bugs out, right? Or keeping weather out. That's like human image bearing, you know, to make our dwellings and to build something worthwhile. But in the desire to scale that up and to make that efficient and make it work in a modern economy, at some point they switched from what at one time would have been a personal sales call from a salesperson, usually a salesman back in the day. They switched from that to this kind of automated way of getting this done. And what it creates is a world where we're kind of constantly opening letters, opening notifications, swiping on our screen, swiping right or left on our apps, hoping to make a personal connection. But it's all behind this layer of technological mediation that leaves us very hungry. So maybe that's one way of kind of setting up what I think is at stake here.
How do you think, you know, anything humans do for any extended period of time? There's, you know, obviously a lot written about like neuroplasticity, how malleable human beings are based on experience.
Right.
Do you think there's any sort of consequential ways in which we, particularly today in the digital age, are being rehabituated, reformed, essentially, even in our desires, maybe? I've heard you say this, and it was like a real paradigm shift for me. There's that phrase, digital natives, you know, young people, emerging generations are digital natives. And you're the first person I heard say in a room, I was in a room with you, and you said, there are no digital natives. And it goes back to what you just said earlier. It's right. A big part of the book. Every human is born looking for another human, looking for them. And yet, we all know many young people, maybe most of the young people in our lives, who have been rehabituated.
Right.
There's a lot written about now about sort of the increase of social anxiety and all sorts of things. I don't know. Do you think there are consequential ways in which we are being reformed because we are now so accustomed to the personalized email or personalized letter and less accustomed to the actual person?
Yes, I have a couple of thoughts about that. One is that this personalized world delivers some things we actually want, in addition to things we really would not rather not have, like unnecessary window sales. And that is basically control. So Sherry Turkle, who obviously is such an important student of our moment and our age, our digital age, at one point, a number of years ago now, but this is still, I think, very accurate, asked college students who she studies closely in her lab, her psychology lab, why they preferred to text rather than talk to their friends. And the answer comes down to control. So when I text you, as opposed to when I talk with you, even in a mediated environment like this, like I can see you, you can see me, and I don't actually have complete control over this conversation. Not only are you asking me questions I may not anticipate, but as I respond, I'm doing so in a way that you pick up information that I'm not intending to send you, for better or for worse. Now, that can be tremendously enriching of our relationship, and it's actually what relationships are made of in some ways, is all the lines of communication we can't control. But it's unsettling, right, to be on my end and knowing that you're seeing and hearing things that I may not want you to see or hear, or inferring things I may not want you to infer. And if I could just text you, I would have at least many more degrees of control. So I think we all get some things out of this thinner way of relating. And I absolutely believe people come to prefer it, at least in some settings, or some people do. The metaphor that comes to mind, Jay, is from another development in technology, which is recorded music. So one of the things that's made recorded music possible in the digital era is compression. So a full fidelity audio stream is, I forget the numbers, but, you know, megabits per second of information. The kind of musical experience you have should you go to a really complex acoustical environment like a symphony orchestra, I mean, that's an incredible amount in information theory, an incredible amount of information that your ears and your audio system, your own internal nervous system are able to process. Well, that doesn't really fit. And especially in the early days of the internet, did not fit through these very narrow pipes we have in the form of media. So we have these increasingly sophisticated algorithms to compress, of which the one that everybody will know is MP3, right? So MP3 can be done at different bit rates. It can have higher or lower rates of compression. So you would think that what people would prefer is the real thing. That is, the more it sounds like the real original sound, the real sound that was present when it was first recorded, you'd think people would prefer that. And until about 15 years ago, they did. In other words, when you played people like CD quality sound, which is very good, or I think there's actually one level even above CD, people were like, oh, that's the best. And, you know, there were audiophiles who like devoted their lives to reproducing sound through recording as best as they could. About 15 years ago, the preferences of younger listeners started to change. And when you play them a CD quality file, and then you play them a highly compressed MP3 file, they actually prefer the compressed audio. Their brain has changed because so much of their consumption of sound has been through earbuds and through compression that that's sort of the natural soundscape for them. Now, in fact, this has lost all kinds of fidelity that was present in the original source, that's present in the real world around us. But their brains have been kind of, with no intention and with no, you know, sense of even dislocation on the part of the listener. Like, it just, oh, this is what it's supposed to sound like, and I prefer it to sound compressed. So I think that's a pretty powerful metaphor, that indeed we can relearn what to expect from the world. So we basically expect less of the world. We expect sounds to be less complex. We expect other people to be less complex. We expect communication to be simpler. And I think that's a loss. It is technically a loss in audio. Like, you literally have lost information about what that originally sounded like. But then if you think about it as a metaphor for what's happening to our relationships, what's happening for our expectations of what a relationship is, I think there is a loss there. The one other thing I'd say, though, is neuroplasticity, by the grace of God, works both ways. So yes, you can be trained into preferring the levels of control you get from digital, and even if you a highly compressed MP3. But if you start seeking the real, your brain will readjust and want the real again. And I feel like I've been through that in my own life, because I would say in my late 30s, early 40s, when I started really availing myself of all this fun digital stuff that became available to us, that was 10 plus years ago now, I'm 56 now, I got completely habituated to it. And then about 10 years ago, I started seriously dehabituating myself. And now I know what it's like, because I felt it to be, you know, people talk about being addicted to your phone. I absolutely was dependent on my phone. And now I'm like, I can't even quite remember what that felt like. I know it happened. I know it when I see it in other people, but my phone's sitting here not too far away. But it has no, I can truly tell you, like, I'm free of it. Like, the thing, it's partly because I turned off all the things that make it habituating and addicting, right? I now use it in a very different way. And having done that, my brain over about 10 years just has rewired. So neuroplasticity is like another word for grace, I think, honestly.
Wow. Yeah. That's a profound thought, just that neuroplasticity is a form of grace. I want to keep sort of trekking down that mode of thinking a little bit. You write about what you call the superpower zone, which initially sounds awesome. I would like that. That sounds great. You remind us of, you know, I grew up reading comic books, and you talk about superheroes and comic books. And I never thought about it this way until I heard you read you writing about it, that, you know, one of the profound things about comic books, the magical thing about it, is that we have these superheroes, Spider-Man and Superman, whoever else, and they do these things that are so far beyond normal human capacity, and yet they do it effortlessly. You know, Superman doesn't have to, I mean, unless he's in, you know, there's some kryptonite or something, but most of the time, he doesn't have to sit there and muster the energy and the strength or what. He just, if right. he wants to fly, he's just like, see you later. And he flies. And, You know, in Spider-Man, he's just swinging through Manhattan with like without a care in the world. He's just doing it. And you say you're connecting that sort of mythology to technology, yeah. to like real life technology. And you say that the superpower zone, you describe it as the domains in which technology has equipped human beings. And this is the key, to vastly increase the sensation of strength while vastly reducing the sensation of effort. I have heard you talk about this many times, and it never ceases to just really arrest me. So talk more about that for folks who've never thought about technology that way. For people who are like, Andy, what are you talking about? My phone just helps me, and it's a helpful tool. Talk about what's happening in us and this sort of the sensation of strength and the reduction of the sensation of effort.
You know, I don't doubt that we get all kinds of things done with technology we could not get done another way. And some of it is genuinely valuable. But this quest for effortless power is, there's one thing it doesn't get done. Let me put it this way. It doesn't form you. It doesn't develop you. It probably does form and shape you in that way that listening to, you know, an MP3 long enough will form your kind of desires for what you want to hear. And this, by the way, I am pretty sure this is new. That is to say, I don't think there was a way to get anything done in the world. And I mean at the level of basic physical work, as well as more abstract things like knowledge or relationship for that matter. I don't think there was any way to think you were accomplishing that before technology without you becoming someone different. You had to develop strength. There's this legend, oh, I'm not going to remember the name of the Greek athlete who allegedly had a young calf, and every day he lifted the calf. So like initially, I don't know, it's 40 pounds. And eventually he could lift a full-grown bull because he never skipped a day, right? And so, you know, start with something easy or relatively easy, do it day after day, and you eventually become the kind of person who can lift incredibly heavy weights, right? Well, you can now lift really heavy weights with a machine, I mean, a forklift or a bulldozer or whatever, but your body doesn't change. In fact, your body actually dwindles in its strength the more you use those machines. And the superpower zone is the feeling of delight that comes from getting something done without having to become anything. And that's quite a delicious feeling. Like I'm accomplishing something in the world, but look, I barely have to like move a finger to get this done. That's magic. That's delightful. That's rewarding. And it doesn't come with this sensation of exertion and kind of the humbling limits of oneself, whether it's your body's actual strength or your mental attention and acuity, you know, all these things that kind of bring us up short and make us say, I'm not enough for this, or I'm not enough yet. I'm playing a pretty difficult piece with my son on Saturday at a little fun little family concert we're doing. It's this Brahms Viola Sonata. My son plays viola. I play piano. The first thing I'm going to be doing after we talk here is going back down to the piano, because there's like four passages in it that honestly today, Thursday, I cannot play. And Saturday, I need to be able to play. And between now and then is the extremely humbling reality of practice. I have to like just take that one little passage, do it very slowly, over and over, making sure I get it right. And I know myself and my abilities well enough that I know if I do about 3 hours between now and Saturday, I who cannot play it today will be able to play it 2 days from now. This is not like learning to play the piano. This is just, but I like trained for years to play the piano, and I still have to do this very humbling thing. Well, if you want to hear that piece, I can send you a Spotify link right now where you'll hear it played flawlessly, maybe more flawlessly than the original performance because they can fix it in post-production, right? And in one sense, I never need to exert myself at all to hear that piece of music. But if I'm going to actually play it myself, I'm going to have to do this thing that's like the opposite of superpowers, which is take a very small part of it, focus on it with a degree of attention that is not natural. Your brain and body are fighting that attention for I'll do 30-minute increments of practice 6 times over the next 2 days. Every moment of that, my brain and body will go like, isn't there something more interesting we could do right now? Like literally the distraction, the restlessness. The other thing that happens though, usually about 15 minutes into that, is you enter this state that has been popularized with this word flow. where as you're doing this very difficult thing, you suddenly kind of get deeply into it. And I don't know, your brain and body get entrained, as they say, and suddenly you're present to the work and the world in a way that you're almost never at any other time. And I think what's so dangerous about the superpower zone, this kind of feeling of, ooh, it's just happening, which happens when you press play on music and hear a great piece of music, is it sort of puts you in something like flow, but without the development of your neuromuscular presence in the world. And ultimately, I think without the development of heart, soul, mind, and strength. So does that make sense? That's maybe a long explanation. Yeah,
absolutely.
And the thing is, until 100 years ago, to get anything of substance done in the world, you had to be a person who practiced. You had to be a person who developed your strength or your attention or whatever capacity was called for. And now you don't. And now you can have kind of a simulation of that delightful experience, but without the development, without becoming.
I want to ask you to talk a little bit more about that. I mean, there's so much there that I think for folks who are listening who just never thought about it this way before, there's probably a lot to ponder here. You mentioned flow, the Mihaly Csikszentmihalyi sort of concept of flow. And for anybody interested, I think we've talked about it before on this podcast. Anyone interested, they can Google it and find more information. One of the components of flow, as I understand it, is that this gets to your point about the superpower zone, that like a high level athlete, for example, or a high level musician that's practicing a particular piece, when they get into that flow state, Csikszentmihalyi talks about, I'm paraphrasing him, but the sort of like challenge and skill balance, that there is this dance where you are pushing and exerting and stretching yourself, but not to the point where it's overwhelming and exhausting to the point of sort of feeling defeated. There is a balance. And like you said, it is like that, you know, lifting the 40-pound calf and doing it every day, where every day there is the challenge skill balance, but you realize 10 years in, that challenge skill balance has evolved, where now the challenge requires a 140-pound, you know, animal, not the 40-pound calf. That would no longer be challenging. It would be easy. So I want to connect that to so many of our listeners who, I think a big reason from feedback, one of the reasons why they listen is because they feel the challenge that actually feels impossible, and they do not feel skilled enough to meet the challenge of experiencing the loving presence of God in a real, tangible way in the everyday rhythms of their lives. And I think I grew up, Andy, sort of unintentionally being taught that the presence of God is easy, that it should feel like the superpower zone, that I should be, this was before smartphones, but somehow, some way, I should be able to push a few buttons in my heart or in my mind, and then voila, there is the presence of God.
Wow.
And then the tension was, it never worked that way. It was never that easy. And thinking about flow, I wonder if there was a part of like an imbalance, that there is a challenge, but I never really did the work consistently enough of developing the skill. So talk a little bit about that, about flow and about the myth of the superpower zone when it comes to the life of the follower of Jesus who wants to experience God deeply on a regular basis.
Yes. I mean, I think many days, to my humbling chagrin, I guess, given that I have been following Jesus for 40 plus years actively, intentionally, or have intended to do that for 40 years, many days I'm like, oh, this is just too hard. And I choose other more more immediately kind of, I don't know if satisfying is the right word, but adequate things than practicing the presence of God, right? And doing the slow disciplines that don't necessarily seem to work in the moment, that nonetheless, both my own experience at its best and the testimony, kind of the teachers of the spiritual life say, hey, this is the way. If you do this consistently over a long period of time, you will start to open up to the reality of God. Here's one way to look at this. One of the things that bothers me about contemporary worship music, there's two things actually to say about contemporary worship music. One is it is absolutely the number one way people seek to have kind of worship superpowers is to get into an environment where this amazing music is being made by other people and it feels like a worshipful environment. So put on your worship playlist on Spotify. I'm not saying this is an all bad thing to do, but if that's your way of like shortcutting to get the sense of spirituality, right, without actually having to be a person of prayer, that's a problem. And I think a lot of what people, even people who show up to church are sometimes looking for is hoping that the worship band is that like, will create the worship superpowers for us. The worship band is like Superman for worship. And the rest of us just want to fly along, like hitch a ride on the cape, rather than actually becoming the kind of people who ideally everywhere we go, but especially when we gather with fellow believers, like in ourselves is the capacity without any amplification, without even necessarily, certainly without all the instruments and all that. I think music and singing always kind of spontaneously have emerged from the life of Christians, but that we can do it ourselves. But how much of our worship now is like a consumer experience designed to sort of activate the sensation that I'm in the loving presence, in love with the loving presence of a loving God? So that's one thing. I think that's one of the main ways we like try to do the shortcut. And in that way, Christians with worship music in their earbuds are not that different from all of our neighbors who put various kinds of music in their earbuds to kind of give us the soundtrack for the life we wish we had. But here's my other concern about contemporary worship music, Jay. A great deal of it expresses mystical thoughts and sentiments that like 0.001% of Christians in history have ever legitimately been able to say they attained. Like, so it's basically about the final stage of union between the soul and God, which is likened in scripture and then in the mystical tradition to the relationship of lovers. It's the relationship of the lover to the beloved. So, you know, Julian of Norwich can talk this way. Teresa of Avila can talk this way. But these are people who, for one thing, through tremendous suffering and then through tremendous like preparation of the heart and the soul and the body, came to a point of being able to have these experiences where they truly felt merged with the love that is God in a way that almost romantic language is the only adequate language for. And you come into worship Sunday morning in a lot of churches, 9:30 a.m., you're on your second cup of coffee, you were yelling at the kids in the car, and you're like, you're the only one I want, Jesus. And just like these extravagant, quasi-erotic language that the church for 2000 years was like, do not use that language unless you are like a certified saint. Mm. Yeah. So we do this leap over what it actually feels to be like to be a Christian for me and into this realm that is not false because it is what is promised to us. I mean, the wedding supper of the Lamb, we will all ultimately be united to Christ in this way. It sets this bar, like this is what it should feel like. And it's not exactly wrong. Like, yes, that is the goal, but that's the goal reached by the people who in the most profound way apprentice themselves to this long obedience, not how you're supposed to feel on any given day or how you will likely feel on any given day, given how few calves you've been lifting in the meantime. Does that make sense?
Absolutely. Yeah. I mean, Yeah, I think this is probably such a gut punch. In many ways, it's a gut punch to me. It's like, oh, I think we sing that song that you just, you know.
I honestly
get it.
You should do an audit. If you're a worship leader, a pastor, including you, my brother, you should do an audit of the songs and think about which of these are just realistic, are unrealistic for our congregation to sing, like just knowing where we're at. And don't sing them because they... I'm not saying we shouldn't proclaim the goodness of God. Like what I'm talking about specifically, the personal, highly individual kind of, and frankly, the only word for it is eroticized, like language that is authorized by the mystical tradition, but not, it never was just sort of indiscriminately used by the Christian population. It was always recognized like this is, it's like when Paul says he knows someone who was caught up to the, whichever heaven it is, the third heaven. And he says, you know what? I'm not even going to talk about that. Like, yeah, I did experience. I mean, he pretty clearly is talking about himself, though he won't even say that directly. He says, I know somebody who. Instead, he's like, I think I'm going to talk about the thorn. I will boast in the thorn. And what we have now is worship that is where the thorn is hardly mentioned and is not done justice to in the language and music and sentiment of our worship. And the utter elevation and ecstasy of a certain kind of spiritual experience is spoken about routinely. It's like the opposite of what Paul himself modeled.
I want to give us a moment here to ponder the superpower zone and to think about flow. I'm going to ask you to think about a few specific questions, particularly when it comes to your life with God, and specifically the challenge of experiencing deeply and daily His loving presence in a real way all around us. I know that that is a tremendous challenge. It is for me. And I'm certain that it is for many of you listening and watching. Ask yourself the question, have you believed in some form or fashion the myth of the superpower zone, specifically when it comes to your life with God? Do you expect His presence, His tangible presence, to be easy and immediately accessible at the push of an emotional or spiritual button, a particular thing or methodology that you think should lead to this deep, rich experience of His presence at a moment's notice? What sort of skills, spiritual practices, or disciplines might you need to intentionally begin committing to and developing to meet the very real challenge of experiencing the loving presence of God in a tangible way on a daily, deep basis? Take a few moments, ponder those questions, and we'll return to our conversation with Andy Crouch.
It's easy to feel disillusioned by the church's misguided culture wars, but we can reclaim the cultural mandate to be the creative cultivators God designed us to be. In a new expanded edition of his book, Culture Making, Andy Crouch unpacks the complexities of how culture works, the dynamics of cultural change, and tools for cultivating culture. With a conversation between Crouch and Tish Harrison Warren as the new afterword, this new edition addresses the current landscape and forges a creative way forward. Stay tuned until the end of the episode to find out how you can get 25% off Culture Making at ivypress.com.
Such a profound thought. It does, you know, for folks who are listening, maybe who are church leaders, these are some things I've been thinking about in recent years, much of it due to just conversations with Andy and things I've seen from Andy. And it's been so helpful. And I just want to give this encouragement. It's not an impossible mountain to climb. I know it feels like that because the sort of modern Western evangelical worship music catalog feels just so overrun with, but all of our songs are just about me and God and our intimate, deep, passionate love for each other. And one, I would say, if we expand our horizons to a larger swath of music, both modern and ancient, that's out there, there is such a robust sort of catalog that is accessible to us. The other thing that has been helpful for us, Andy, you mentioned it already. Actually, just before I jumped on this call with you, I was in our weekly sort of looking ahead to the next couple of weeks meeting with our worship pastors. And one of the things that they've shifted to is, it's simple, but it's been profound, to moving toward much more we instead of I sort of singing.
Yes.
It helps so much.
Yep.
Yeah. And it's true to the actual embodied experience. I'm in this room with all of these other people.
Wow.
And yes. Our worship leaders have gotten into the mode of regularly reminding folks when we say we, yes, it is we in this room, but it is the great, grand, beautiful we of the followers of Jesus for many generations.
Yes.
Join them, the cloud of witnesses and the global church who are gathering all over the world. We are somehow, by God's Spirit, sort of bound up in this family together. And then another thing that has been helpful is, again, this sort of came from my learnings from you, is to ask the question, okay, if we sing these four songs or these five songs, we were just talking about this an hour ago, do these four or five songs at least begin to paint a picture of the spectrum of human experience? Or is it five songs that's just all about, oh, God is so good and he loves me so much and I'm so passionately in love with him? Or do they reflect the Psalms, you know, where there is much pain and doubt and anguish? And yet it makes me think of the Psalm of Ascents. Again, going back to the superpower zone, you know, Psalm 120 to 130 something.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
They didn't just sing those songs. They walked those
songs. Yes. Wow.
They felt them. They climbed, you know, they had their legs hurt as they sang.
And the more
we can do some of that, it feels like it's a way for us to get into to experience flow, at least put ourselves in position to experience flow and to sort of remove ourselves from the superpower zone. Gosh, I could, this is a whole other conversation, Andy, that I could have with you about worship music. But I want to make sure, without giving away the book, I can't recommend it more highly, but without giving away the whole book, you have these three key shifts in the life we're looking for that are really practically helpful to live more fully as persons in our technological age. You talk about moving from devices to instruments, seeing our technological tools as instruments and not devices. And then in our own lives, moving from families to households, and then going from charmed to blessed. So I know I'm posing a tremendous challenge to you, but are you able to briefly and succinctly just
give 2 minutes?
You got more than 2 minutes, but just sort of like clue us in. What do you mean by those shifts?
Well, they're all shifts in the direction of, in some ways, the harder, better life, I would say. And so the shift from devices to instruments is actually what we ask our technology to be. Rather than asking it to primarily give us superpowers, we actually go back to what human beings have always done, which is treat it as a tool. But instrument to me is such a good word because, you know, we talk about scientific instruments, for example, and they can be very high tech. So I'm married to a scientist, an experimental physicist, my wife, Catherine. And if you walk into Catherine's lab, like it's full of technology, but it's all used as a tool for human beings to do that flow-inducing thing of training themselves for years to get to the edge of human knowledge and be able to like move that frontier just one step further, right? And that's this incredibly beautiful human, actually very communal relational activity, scientific research. And the technology is just there to help human beings be more human. It's not there to find out about the world for us. It's there to like help us do our job, which is what tools do. And it's developmental. The more you use it, the better you get, rather than devices, where the more you use them, the less good you get at whatever you're doing. And the better the device gets, but you don't get better. So one of the things that's interesting about our phones, as we call them, we don't actually talk on them very much like phones, but our smartphones, our smart devices, is they can either be the ultimate device that just does everything for you, entertains you, communicates for you, or they can be the ultimate instrument that actually opens up the world. I think the most fundamental move with technology, what I became convinced as I wrote this book, is as much as technology is a big deal in our world and is shaping our lives, there are some deeper things that have been going on that we have to also rethink. And one is essentially the relational environment we live in. And we've just gotten into this situation. Something like 60% of the housing stock of Manhattan, where I work, our headquarters office is, 60% of those apartments are studio apartments. It's an island of people on islands in their little studio apartment. And most of us don't live in that level of isolation, but even the single family home that's like the default American dream thing, is, I think, not the right scale. We're meant to be embedded in more relationships than just your marriage, if you happen to be married, or your parent and child, you know, the kind of nuclear family. We are the first people in history to try to live in such a lonely way, frankly. And we do it because we can afford it also. Like, I think actually a lot of people would like to live with less proximity to people. It's just they can't afford it. And modern people in some places and times can. But what you get is isolation. So the call to households is actually to re-knit our lives together with other people who live with us, with neighbors, with people who have a key to your house, even if they don't live in your house, who are just so interwoven with your life. This is the way the ancient world lived all the time. And then the deepest one. So, you know, devices and instruments is rethinking this 100-year story of technology. You know, small units to households is rethinking our relational matrix. But the deepest one is what I call from charmed to blessed, because I realized a few years ago that when I myself use the word blessed to describe myself, what I actually should have been saying charmed. I've lived a charmed life in the sense that some forms of suffering that come to most people have not come to me. And some forms of affluence and opportunity that don't come to most people have come to me. And it's not actually because God was like, I want Andy to have that. And I don't want any other, you know, all these other people, too bad. I want him to be relatively free of major illness. I want him to not lose his parents in childhood, let's say. I want him to have, you know, opportunities. No, it's because I'm kind of charmed for a season of my life. The magic kind of worked for me in a way that doesn't work for every person. But blessing is found in the midst of and on the other side of suffering. And, you know, you mentioned the Psalms. Psalm 22 in some ways is one of the most amazing, because it is the psalm that Jesus quotes or invokes when he's on the cross. And it's the psalm of a sufferer who nonetheless, by the end of the psalm, is proclaiming the goodness of God. And that's blessing. It's not avoiding suffering or getting these kind of cheat codes to the universe. Blessing is actually being implicated in all the sorrow of the universe and all the sorrow of your own story and that of those around you. And nonetheless, finding that there is real life in the midst of it and beyond it. And until we decide, some of us are charmed. There are people who are just born good looking. You are one of them, by the way, Jay. and you know, whatever. But once we realize I am not here to seek that, I'm not trying to grasp it. I'm not trying to recreate it. I'm on the path to blessing. I think that's what actually unlocks the way through this lonely world that we're living in.
What a gift. You just gave us a gift. Yeah, Andy, again, I could sit here and just hit stop and keep talking to you for a long time. But you've already given us so much. I think there's so much to consider and ponder here in so many different ways. As we close, you know, you talked about being blessed. In the book, you talk about the hashtag blessed, yeah, you know,
and it's charmed.
Yeah, it's totally charmed. It never looks like true blessing in the sort of biblical vision of blessing. So with that in mind, I think, especially for all of us, but especially for those of us who are listening or watching right now, and maybe, you know, your words just now feel like a small beam of light cutting through what has been a very dark cloud over us, where maybe we've believed the lie that we are not blessed because life has been so hard, that God's blessing has been removed from us because there is so much grief or pain, especially for those of us in that season right now. Would you just give us a final closing word of blessing, of real blessing?
Well, I mean, I'm not going to be able to improve on this, but I also don't have it completely memorized. So I just think the word would be, may the Lord be gracious to you. May the Lord lift up his countenance upon you. That is, may you discover that you are beheld, right? It's like someone's been looking down and then they lift up their face and they're looking at you. May he lift up his countenance upon you, and may God give you peace. It's not the charm of just nothing bad happening, but it is knowing the presence of one who holds it all and will repair it all. That's the promise. So may that be real for us.
And Andy Crouch, you are a gift to me and to so many. So grateful. Thank you for joining us today.
Gosh, thank you, Jay.
I hope this conversation with Andy Crouch was inspiring and helpful to you. My hope and my prayer for you is simple, that today, as you go about your day, you might remember two things. One, you are a person with a name, a person who is seen and known and loved by the God who made you. And two, that experiencing the loving presence of this God who sees you and knows you and loves you, this God who so desperately longs to be with you, experiencing his loving presence in a tangible way, in a real way, will not come without effort. That you might begin to reorient and maybe restructure your life, all of life, heart, soul, mind, and strength, around his presence that is right in front of you. If you would just remove the barriers and the challenges with intentionality and with strength and with skill to experience his loving presence daily and deeply. I want to leave you with our closing prayer and benediction. Father, Son, and Holy Spirit, in this still moment, we pause to rest and relax into your presence. We thank you for the gift of this day, for the moments of light and levity, and all of your many graces, big and small. Help us to notice the goodness you weave in and through all things. Help us to reflect honestly on our missteps, to bring them to you humbly. We trust in your mercy, which is always healing, always restoring. Remind us of your nearness in our joy, our sorrow, and all our in-betweens. As we look to tomorrow, grant us the courage to surrender our plans to your care. Fill us with a trust that is grounded in your goodness, and open our hearts wide to your love, that we may carry your grace into the world. Amen. The Digital Examine is a production of InterVarsity Press. For more information on any IVP titles mentioned on this episode, visit ivpress.com and use code IVPOD25. That's IVPOD25 for 25% off. Sound engineering by Honest Podcasts. Our producers are Helen Lee, Travis Albritton, and Christine Policio Mello. Our production assistant is Jack Reese, and I'm your host, J.Y. Kim. Don't forget to subscribe to our show on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or the IVP YouTube channel, and leave a rating and review to support the show.